the last session of the day, which is rate regulation activities. And we welcome Jane.
Thank you, Martin. Good afternoon, everybody. And thank you for agreeing to participate in the session on rate regulated activities, which some of you may have noticed in reading the first paragraph of paper 7. You don't need to know much about rate regulated activities to participate in the discussion. The reason being that we are trying in the rate regulated activities project to identify whether we can come up with a better way of representing the activities of rate regulated entities using the existing principles within IFRS 15, revenue from contracts with customers, and also using the existing and the proposed definitions of assets and liabilities in the conceptual framework, which, as you know, the board are working on updating. And whenever we talk to people in rate-regulated industries, there's always a bias to their answers to the questions that we ask them. And so what we're looking for this afternoon from you people is coming at this with a clean eye, a fresh approach, to look at what you perceive as being performance and what you think should be recognised as assets and liabilities. And then our job is to take away those answers and to try and turn that into an analysis that we're going to use for our board members and others to try and get a link from general business activities, what people perceive in other types of industries, and can we get a bridge across to them. The paper, and I do apologise if it seems a little bit like an exam paper with a here's a question with different alternatives and what's your answer. The reason for that again is just to try and get a cold approach from you people. We're trying not to lead you down any particular path, so we've tried to leave this as open as possible. The scenario, just to clarify, it's a simplified kind of situation, but it is based on real-life examples that we have seen from regulated industries. It may seem fairly familiar to some of you where a government, in this case, has identified there's a growing population in a city. It needs to build a new town or a new suburb on the edges of the city to cope with that population boom. And because we're dealing with water services here, it's considered to be essential to the population in the area. So the government has become involved through its regulatory body, the rate regulator, to work with the water company to try and make sure that the water services can cope with this increase in the population. And the government, in deciding to increase the capacity for population, includes housing, etc. So it's working with property developers to build some new houses and other facilities. And then is looking and working with the water company to decide that the existing infrastructure, including the water treatment plant, is not capable of operating to the increased capacity that this new town is going to bring, and therefore a new water treatment plant needs to be built in order to maintain the continuity and the quality of the service into the future. And the government, through the regulator, is looking at how can this new infrastructure, this new water treatment plant, be funded, and has come up with four alternative scenarios. One is to just allow the water treatment, the water company itself to find the funding needed to build the water treatment plant. And then once the water treatment plant comes into operation, the company can charge the customers an increased price to try and recover the cost of construction of that water treatment plant. Bearing in mind, in a rate regulated environment, the rate regulator does determine when the price increase can come through, how much that price increase is, and in this case can actually increase the payback or shorten the payback period, because although the economic life of the plant is considered to be 40 years, the increase in the price for water services covers a 10-year period to recover the 20 million cost of the construction of the water treatment plant. By the way, we're just ignoring interest for the time being for simplicity, but that would be built in as well. The second option is to provide the water company with a government grant up front, so they have the cash in place, they then build the water treatment plant, and then they can provide the services to the customers as those new customers come online. The implication of a rate-regulated environment here is that when the government provide that funding through a grant, most typically the regulator prevents the water company from reflecting the cost of construction in the prices that they charge to customers. On the basis the government say, or the regulator says, you haven't incurred the 20 million cost, we have given you the 20 million funding for it, therefore you cannot get that money out of the customers, you've had it already. So there is a restriction on the price that's charged to customers. The third option, which I've used this example in another situation before, and people said, does this really happen, Jane? It does really happen in practice. The government is working with the property developers in order to build all of these new residential homes. The property developers will be then selling those homes to a lot of people, and the government says, okay, instead of us getting the water company to build the water treatment plant, let's get the property developers to build it. They can recover the cost by selling the properties to the individual customers, but once construction is completed, they must gift the water treatment plant to the water company, who will then run that water treatment plant to provide the services to the customers, the residents of those new properties. Again, in that situation, the philosophy of the rate regulator is that the water company has not incurred the 20 million cost of construction and therefore won't be able to recover that 20 million through prices charged to customers. So the price to customers for water services will not reflect the cost of construction of the water treatment plant. The fourth option is just a slight variation of the first one. Instead of waiting until the water company has got a loan, built the water plant, and then starts operating and charging customers, we've got a couple of years before the water treatment plant comes online where the prices have already been increased to customers, so there's a little bit of pre-funding for the water company, and the remainder of the recovery of the cost of the plant then comes through in the later years. Again, the twist here in rate regulation is that the rate regulator doesn't allow the company to discriminate between existing customers that are not going to be using this new water treatment plant, they're already using the plant that's in place, and the new customers that are going to benefit from this new water treatment plant. Of course, there is a benefit to existing customers. The new water treatment plant means that they won't be suffering, or shouldn't be suffering, a reduction in the quality of their services because of the increased population. They'll still be using the old water treatment plant, but will that plant has the capacity to cope with it. Okay, so before I turn over the floor and ask for your answers to the exam question, has anybody got any questions? Would they like to clarify any of the fact pattern?
One question, what is the... Who is carrying the risk usually? So let's assume 2 years after everyone had moved into this area, people identify that this is an earthquake area and everyone moves away again. Is that the risk in this case of the water company, or is there usually an agreement that the government would guarantee for a certain level of future revenues?
It's a very valid question and a very difficult one to give a definitive answer to, particularly with that word guarantee. And typically what happens is that there's a lot of homework being done to make sure that this is going to be a viable project. So the chances of everybody disappearing after 2 years is extremely remote. So in entering into this agreement, both the rate regulator, the government, and the water company are fairly confident with the pattern of or the demand for services going forward over quite a number of years. If something was to happen, so for example in option one where the company has to fund the construction, if something was to happen in 2 or 3 years' time that meant the demand for those water services was so much below the anticipated level in drawing up this agreement, typically what would happen is that the price to the existing customers would change in order to make sure that recovery would happen, or the government would need to step in some other way to make sure the water company would be able to recover those costs. So it's not a straightforward guarantee that you will definitely get the money, but typically there's a mechanism in place to work out some way of making sure they do.
Kevin?
Jane, so I have an element of confusion. What you've explained, I deal with daily, and I'm not in a rate-regulated activity. So to get a mining license, and I'm going to build a new mine in a certain area, the government requires me normally to establish a school, to establish hospitals, and all of that. And for that, they relax the labour laws. I can retrench people earlier, I can pay less than the minimum statutory minimum wage. It sounds like everything that you've been saying, but I already deal with it under IAS 16. No, you know, you sort of worry me that maybe I've got the accounting wrong for when I've created my mines, because they're all conditions of getting the license to operate, so which I get offsetting benefits, but, you know, not that, you know, in terms of pricing, say in terms of lower salaries or whatever that the government's off, or even a reduced royalty.
So your benefits don't come through the revenue line, they come through other
through the cost lines
with the government.
They come through the cost line as opposed to the revenue line. But it's a condition of getting the mining license. And especially if you're, you know, like the mine we operated in Guinea, I had to electrify the town, which didn't exist. So the government brought in people to build the anticipated new workforce that were going to migrate in, but I was responsible for the electrification, and for which I got reduced labour rates.
And I think it is out of scope what we're doing, because
yes, but
coal,
you know,
is not an essential product, I think, for the community, and therefore I think
people... Yeah, and I'm seeing you more a little bit along the lines of the property developer that's incurring... It's kind of a different side of the equation. There is, I appreciate the detail then maybe crosses over in other ways, but it'd be interesting then to see how you deal with the question that's in the paper here in terms of the assets and liabilities that you're booking and the income and the expenditure that's to be booked in this case.
What we've done for the assets, if the asset is a life of mine asset, then it's life of mine, but if the asset, like the electrification plant, we knew we would have to change it over at regular intervals, so it's the electrification plant works with a shorter term life depending on the underlying asset, but it's all part of our cost of building the mine and cost to operate the mine.
Could I have a shot at explaining it my way? So if you think of this as the water company's got a license to operate the water system, and what they're allowed to do is to charge a rate that will be agreed by the regulator to cover their costs plus interest plus reasonable profit margin. And so if nothing else was happening, they'd expect to get that return based on the cost they've incurred and the kind of flattish sort of margin. And then when additional things happen, they get the right to charge more above that originally agreed tariff. And so there's a more direct connection between these additional costs that are incurred and the revenue that's going to come in. In the sort of extreme example Jane specified here, there's a very tight link between what comes in. Obviously, it can be more of a grey area in between, but I think that's the difference. In a sense, it's a bit closer to a financial instrument that they incur the costs, and as a result, as a fairly direct result, that they're going to get some extra revenue at some point, at least in some of these scenarios.
In our case, in the country that I'm considering, we got a 20% cut in the minimum wage, but when the gold price dropped for the first 8 years, when the gold price dropped, it changed to 12.
Can we maybe have Mary then and Changwu and then really discussing your examples, because otherwise we...
Well, I think in some ways Kevin's comment relates back to Christoph's question and Jane's answer. It's my follow-on to Peter's personal attempt to clarify. I think in these cases, assume that demand risk rests largely, but not strictly legally, with the regulator rather than with the entity, because of the mechanisms Jane described. And so it's demand risk. You know, demand risk, I think, is part of the differentiation between these scenarios and what Kevin explained, because the driver for the demand of gold is different from the terms of your license. And so I would say everybody should answer these assuming that in the short to medium term, demand risk, the company will be insulated from demand risk by the regulatory structure. If you're talking about a city that eventually is going to empty because of shift in population patterns, et cetera, the regulator isn't going to step in with a guarantee and make you whole, but short to medium term, insulated from demand risk.
Jane,
might be not basically the similar idea. However, a kind of licensing is a kind of many obligations. So one of them, if the water company has a licensing, then this water company must provide a new plant if new areas develop, is going to develop. So if we make some kind of analogy you just suggested, we can't just say this case is just related to our option C, because this is water company is another entity that have a kind of a licensing. Then the obligation, one of the obligations with the regulator, we should provide some kind of additional service. In that case, you know, you're saying this is a kind of a different perspective from the we are thinking about. It's very interesting.
Yes, when I read this, I thought we were talking about how to approach it from an IFRS 15 perspective. One of the first questions I would ask is, you know, in evaluating the nature of the arrangement, is it a collaborative arrangement, or is the arrangement a contract with a customer? Is customer the government, or is the customer the people that you're providing the service to?
Jane, do you mind if I
please do?
Yep. I think the characterization of this memo of taking an IFRS 15 revenue approach is to distinguish it from some of the historical U.S. practices, U.S. GAAP practices, which are looking at costs and trying to defer costs to another period. Mm-hmm. When this says IFRS 15, it means at a very high level that instead of focusing on cost, think about what is the activity that earns you an entitlement to revenue. Mm-hmm. And so not as focused on pinning down what the contract is, that's really the question that you're being asked to think about. So when we say the encouragement was to build something based on IFRS 15, it meant broadly to think about shifting, impacting the timing of revenue recognition rather than shifting the timing of recognition of expenses for cost.
Okay. Jen, how should we do it now? Should we maybe go to the first scenario and then?
I think that's probably the best way, and maybe just to save time, I'm conscious that it's checking on. The first scenario is where the company has to go out and get a loan to fund the construction. So in year one, I'll kind of suggest what I think are the assets and liabilities and the income and expenditure, and then if anybody's got any alternatives, then leap in. I'll do it slightly differently for the next one. So in year one, we receive the loan, so we've got cash and a liability for the loan at the end of year one. In year two, we then construct the water treatment plant, so we eliminate our cash. We instead have an asset, which is our water treatment plant. At this stage, we're not looking at any income and expenditure. We're purely in the balance sheet assets and liabilities game. In year three, then, we start to actually use the water treatment plant to provide services to the customers. And we're going to start depreciating the water treatment plant. We're going to start receiving revenue from customers because we've been providing services. Anybody disagree so far?
Why can't you think about this like a concession arrangement? Why can't you think about this as a in-the-money option in terms of the value the government's given you to price above what would otherwise be market price? So think about the IFRIC on concessions. especially if you have to have no demand risk, why are you sitting on a PP&E asset? Why aren't you sitting on a financial asset the government's guaranteed to pay you?
It's a good question, and there is a very fine line, and there's a lot of concession arrangements that are very, very similar to the scenarios that we're in for general utility companies. And the what tips you into IFRIC 12, which is the interpretation on concession arrangements, is at the end of a defined period, the concession period, usually the operator will be giving the infrastructure, in this case the water treatment plant, to the regulator, or more generally to a different operator it passes to if there's a change in the operator of the concession arrangement. In this case, the PP&E is the water company's PP&E. The regulation will typically then say that, you know, the reason it says you have to construct the water treatment plant is because the regulation says you have to maintain a particular level of service, and the only way it's feasible to maintain that level of service is with a new water treatment plant. But the way the plant is operated generally is under the control of the water company itself. So it's on the water company's balance sheet, not off balance sheet as it would be in the service concession arrangement.
Well, we get finance lease arrangements that don't show the legal form of what you own, and it's the economic substance of what you're on risk for. I just asked the question.
Yeah.
I think if you were to analogize to service concessions, you'd end up looking more at the intangible scenario than the guarantee scenario in IFRIC 12. And one of the things that we explored in the DP was, should we be looking at an intangible asset-based model? And when Jane's paper said that the feedback was encouraging a focusing on the revenue-based approach, that was in preference to an intangible for the license, the right to run. I'm just saying that was the feedback from the DP.
I wasn't necessarily thinking intangible, because I'm aware of a situation now where there is exactly an infrastructure asset that's in play, but it's not actually being used by anyone in the public. And so the government is actually paying on an annual basis a minimum amount to keep them going, and that's just guaranteed because there is no usage demand at the moment.
I think that's the exception that would fall out of the typical scenario described as defined rate regulation. So for the broad mix of cases that we're talking about being inside the scope of defined regulation, that really fascinating name, I think you'd be thinking more about the intangible model, things that would be kissing cousins of the intangible model rather than the financial guarantee model in the service concession.
So that means there is demand risk if you're on
I said kissing cousin. I didn't say would be in, but it would be closer to that scenario. You're getting protection, not absolute.
Yeah. I think the issue here is that the way the regulation works is it tries to anticipate what's going to happen in order to set up the regulation and the rates in a way that it insulates, as Mary said, it insulates the company from demand risk, but it doesn't eliminate it altogether. So it's not a direct guarantee, although the mechanism is designed to reduce the need to give that direct guarantee.
But it does leave open the question of would a user find intangible, considering this being subject to rate regulation, intangible? As I said, so far the reaction has been no, we'd rather have the details about costs and entitlements rather than a lump called intangible.
Jane, just on a point of clarification, are we trying to deal with rate regulation, for example, in the UK, I can get my electricity from anybody I damn well like, and it's a rate-regulated price? Or are we talking on rate regulation because you happen to be in a monopolistic environment and they want to apply rate regulation? Because that's the rate regulation I'm used to, is the monopolistic environment, because that's the way it works in the third world. And are you looking at two different models depending on...
Well, I think monopolistic environment works in the UK and lots of other countries as
yeah.
well. And because a lot of it is in situations where it's not feasible to have multiple suppliers.
It's both.
It can do both.
Because then I think you start hitting this, is it a concession or is it a rate regulation?
And it's an issue that in the rate regulated activities project, we're going to have to refine what we mean to try and make sure that we're absolutely clear. But at the moment, we're trying to develop a model that we can then... We've got a description of defined rate regulation, which the responses to the DP said it's good as a working basis for developing a model, and it's only, you know, if we can't develop a model, there's no point spending lots and lots of time refining the definition of rate regulation. So what we're trying to do here is just get a feel for what we can build, how we can build a model along the lines of the feedback from the discussion paper, which is identify what are what do we mean by performance, what are the activities the company is doing that will earn revenue, and if we've got any, you know, balances here, what type of assets and liabilities are they? At the moment, a lot of people call them regulatory assets and liabilities, but there's questions, do they meet the definitions of assets and liabilities in the conceptual framework? So we're kind of coming about this from an indirect angle, but we've been struggling to get people focusing in the direct angle, so we're just trying an alternative approach here. But I guess in this first scenario here, the key question, I think, for my purposes, if I'm coming back to being selfish here and getting out of this session what I need, is we've got PP&E on the balance sheet. If we can accept that we're a company, we're operating, the PP&E is on our balance sheet, we're going to be depreciating it. Now, the useful economic life, we're told, is 40 years, but the payback period that the regulator has built into the pricing structure is a 10-year period. So I guess the question is, how would you see the income and expenditure working now from year three onwards? Would you be depreciating over the 40-year period, but recognising the whole of that revenue, the payback of the 20 million over the 10 years? So then we're going to have 30 years where we'll have a depreciation charge going through P&L, but no revenue to match that depreciation charge? Or would you be looking to do some sort of adjustment either to accelerate depreciation or slow down the recognition of the revenue that's designed as the payback?
Don't you wish you didn't ban revenue-based depreciation?
Why can't you think about government grants? Situation too. They've given you the ability to charge above what would otherwise be your market rate, which is in option B and C. Yeah.
So how would
the
you
good news about a project on rate regulation is, unlike the interpretation committee, not as constrained by existing literature and trying to fit it in. So this is really saying, what do you think would give the most meaningful portrayal? And then we get to write the rules.
And I'm looking, if we want to deal with the second scenario, which is the government grant scenario, I guess those of you that are familiar with IAS 20 are familiar that there's two different options in there. We could book the government grant on the balance sheet and then release it and recognise the PP&E. So we've got a 20 million asset for PP&E at the end of year two. We've got a 20 million grant sitting as a credit balance on the balance sheet as well at the end of year two. IS 20 then says if that's the option you take, you then start releasing that government grant through income over the period where we're depreciating the asset. And I don't want to put words into your mouth, but are you depreciating the asset then over the 40-year period, and you'd release the government grant over the 40-year period?
If the government grant's only due to be, if the government grant is has a 20-year life, I'm giving you this grant to provide the water for the next 20 years. If you provide it for 21, good luck to you. Well, then your liability, your obligation to repay the government expires at the end of 20. So why you would amortize the loan over a longer period than the obligation on which you would potentially have to repay, I don't get.
Well, I think that's picking up another good point, I think, which is why is the government giving you that loan, that grant. So what is the service that grant relates to? And so I guess it's a case of looking at the regulation now. In this case, the cash payback period is 10 years in this case, but is that the period over which the government expects you to provide the services to the customer, or is it the 40 years that actually is the useful economic life of the water treatment plant? And I accept I didn't actually clarify that in the fact pattern. My assumption is that it's over the 40 years that we can use the water treatment plant, because
you know, we're not going to be able to change the prices for that 40 years related to that water treatment plant. So if we then take that assumption to say the government are saying, yes, it's a 40-year service period because that's how long you're obliged to use that plant for, because you have to keep providing services throughout the life of that plant, would you then be in Frank's place and putting a 40-year release period?
Yeah, because I'd link the two to the, what, you know, the, I would bifurcate the asset and the liability and treat the asset and the conditions and the liability as the conditions as two separate. If it ultimately comes into a melded situation, great. But see, a lot of this I work on, you're not doing it for nothing. You've got some exclusivity, and therefore the exclusivity must be some type of accounting consequence. So you might, the life of the asset might be 40 years, but if you've only got exclusive use for 20, you've got to keep considering whether a competitor's going to come in at year 21, and so suddenly your asset is useless. So you've always got this perpetual consideration for an impairment test on the asset.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. In IS... Sorry, Steve.
I was going to have a go at... slightly different perspective. So everybody said that for option A, you agreed that revenue in year three would be 2. But I think my understanding is the utility industry would say it isn't 2. They would say it's 0.5. And the accounting entry in year three is debit cash 2, credit revenue 0.5, and credit a liability with 1.5. And then that would be released to revenue in years 11 to 40. Essentially,
yeah.
That's what it is. Because the consequence of recognizing revenue of 2 is that for years 1 to 10, you're going to have higher revenue and higher profit than you will in years 11 to 40, because the government then returns the rate to the lower level once they've given you enough money to pay for the water plant. So the utilities would say, showing higher profit and then a lower profit later isn't fair, it creates volatility. To really reflect the underlying margin we're going to earn from operating this plant, the actual accounting entry in year 3 would be debit cash 2, credit revenue 0.5, credit liability 1.5. Does that make sense?
Except that on Frank's argument, that looks like it's a hedge. And hedge accounting doesn't allow you to just ignore the first 10 years and book it all in the last 20. So the fact that someone's hedged out some of your risk means you must deal with the hedge accounting consequence.
I don't think it's a hedge. I think it's just the government is allowing you to raise prices for the first 10 years and then telling you you've got to put them back down again after that.
So maybe a different way of asking Steve's question. What's the activity that you think should earn you revenue, separating the revenue recognition from when you're allowed to bill and collect? You may be able to bill and collect in advance, you may only be able to do it in arrears. What's the activity? Is it constructing? Is it obtaining the financing? Is it delivering the service? What do you think is the revenue generating activity?
I think the revenue generating activity is delivering the service. The fact that the government is giving me an instruction to overcharge at the beginning, I think that overcharging is what is the hedge against the security of the second 20 years of unlimited monopolistic.
So what's the accounting entry?
I wouldn't necessarily defer the whole 1.5, because I would do a financial instrument hedging effect on that extra cash. There's some element of discounting number that goes in there. It's not just the basic 2.5, 1.5, and then. So I do look at it as if it's someone sold me a hedge.
So Kevin, do you not see? All right, I'm trying to not ask this in the negative. Have you concluded that a requirement to build a new plant is not a revenue generating activity?
No, that's a condition of my license to generate future revenue.
There are no right and wrongs here. I was just trying to get to the bottom of what.
And
what
I
your
do come from
really
my,
implied.
You know, it's that. Yeah. I'm so used to that environment in the right to build my mind. Mm-mm. So you know, that's. I look at it as if I've got a right, and that right I can bifurcate, mm-hmm. and deal with it as a separate right. And if it just so happens the government's giving me a premium, then it's that right gets deferred on that premium over a period, but not as simplistic as 1.5 off. I think there's another mathematic in here.
Well, what is the other mathematic?
I say it's that hedge accounting via a discounting, and if my future costs are expected to do like this, their 1.5 half could result in them making huge losses in years 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20.
Okay, the 1.5 half was
simplistic.
Yeah. But if interest rates are zero and inflation is zero, then are you saying it 1.5 half is fine?
I'm saying if that's the mathematic of, say, on my page that I'm on a hedge, then yes. But because someone, you know, I'm getting protection. So it's an insurance premium, and I deal with insurance premiums over the period of the protection.
So you're viewing it as a cost of delivering the service rather than a revenue-generating activity.
Yeah. I'm a bit worried, puzzled, by because it means that we would have two different accounting treatments, whether I've got this indexation, basically, and revenues, or whether I've got a grant. Mm. And basically, economically, you know, it's the same. We are dealing, you know, either we get the subsidy in form of a grant directly, or we get it through, you know, this possibility to increase prices for a certain period of time. So if I follow you, Kevin, we could have two different accounting treatments.
Okay, but can I then ask the question as we're in debate around it? Does this 20 million, if suddenly instead of 30,000 customers, I get 40,000 customers, could I potentially get 26?
No.
So how is it? How does the pricing get capped? But as the variation in the population changes, am I going to be in? You receive that just it's abuse.
If, yeah, the regulator will do so. If the regulator is anticipating you're going to get that 20 million over the 10-year payback period that they see here, if it seems as though you're going to get accelerated customers, so the demand is higher than they expect, the regulator that would normally pull the price down to make sure that you certainly won't get more than the 20. Now, it may be the regulator possibly would allow you to get the 20 within a 7-year period rather than a 10-year period, or he will just pull the price down. So whatever happens, you're not going to get more than 20.
And the more you're explaining it to me, the more it looks like it's a bifurcatable position and I should treat them all separately.
Yep. It's not revenue.
It's definitely not revenue.
But will it be revenue in years 11 through 30 when you start releasing it through the P&L account?
When the bifurcation?
When, if ever, do you think it's revenue? As opposed to a...
It's like a reimbursement of excess.
I think it sounds more and more like a reimbursable expense, yep. as opposed to a revenue.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yep.
So
it might be revenue linked, but it doesn't sound like revenue.
Well, it is under IFRS 15. It's delivering a service to your customer.
But who's my customer? The government for giving me the license to create this monopolistic environment, or you, the buyer of my water?
Has to be me, the buyer of the water.
I don't think that. I think it's condition of my license, and therefore my customers, the government.
It's like
what goods and services am I transferring to the government?
I'm not. It's a condition of the license. It's not a goods and service.
So I think we're re-debating some of what we did in the DP about is it? No, it's not bad because you know that's what we explored before. Is this an intangible, a license, a right to operate, and these things that you incur somehow affecting the cost basis in that license, or is it somehow directly or indirectly a revenue generating activity? You can argue both sides. Yeah. More people argued revenue generating at some point when we put out the DP.
One thing that interested me in talking about this is the, and correct me if I didn't hear this properly, was that we're trying to get a similar outcome irrespective of the funding mechanism. And so in the government grant case, we're going to be releasing 0.5
mm-hmm.
for 40 years. How are we going to be describing the 0.5? Is that going to be revenue, or is that going to be some other sort of income?
It's just an offset to your depreciation.
I don't think it's income.
So you put it through the expense line, because I'm just trying to reconcile the two.
It's your ability to overcharge to compensate for the costs you incurred, and it's like a sale and lease back on properties. We don't reflect the lease at the off-market rate when you inflate the price that you've paid or underpaid for the property. We always reflect the lease based on the economic situation that you should have had for a true market lease.
I'm interested here, because in IAS 20 on government grants, it does give you an option in the P&L accounts as well as in the balance sheet about netting off. So whether you would show it as income or as a deduction from the expense. So it sounds as though the deduction from the expense is the way through.
Would it said, it depends on which page you're on. Is it a is it the right to the license, or is it the performance obligation to the customer who's switched on the tap? And I don't see how the customer took the tap. He has no choice. He's got to buy my water. So I'm selling it to him at the price, not because that's the price that him and I have negotiated. It's Peter and I have negotiated the price that Stephen's got to pay for my water. I don't know how delivering water to Stephen is revenue because I've negotiated a price with Peter. You're just the receiver of the benefit.
There is a difference, because if Stephen may not pay you, you will have got it immediately. But there you have a customer relationship, and then you may not get the money back.
No, but Jane
Steve
said
doesn't
if,
pe-
if
Mary's
he doesn't
do
pay,
it.
But Jane said, if Stephen doesn't pay, I go to Peter and say, you know that
okay.
Dead meat over there? Can you let me charge more to Michael? And he says yes. So I don't care.
Okay.
But Kevin, before we start getting into the credit risk, if we scroll back to your earlier kind of point counterpoint about is it a cost of my license or is it revenue, the fact that you've negotiated with Peter how much you're going to charge Steve for his water, that may not make the two revenue when he turns on the water. But is it ultimately revenue at some point?
I don't
because you do get to charge Steve that amount. So is it revenue at some point? It just might not be revenue when you charge it.
I think I'm supposed to play semantics with words.
Yeah.
I might be able to collect it from him.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily mean I charged him.
Can I? Sorry.
I don't necessarily go cash flow equals automatic revenue.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I just slightly change the fact pattern, and instead of getting a payback period of 10 years, I made the payback period the 40 years. So I'm just going to charge customers to collect the 0.5 every year for 20 years. Would I book that as revenue? Because that's going to Steve 0.5 every year.
But what's the difference?
There's no change.
What's the? That's no change.
That's my question though, because if I'm collecting 0.5 per year from Stephen for 40 years, I'm booking that to revenue, I think, because that's included in my
Kevin
bill.
Said he
water
wouldn't.
Service.
No, because it's back to the extra 0.5. It's a condition of Peter giving me exclusivity.
No, I'm sorry. I'm saying here that there's no extra now. What I'm doing is matching the cash flow.
So I have no exclusivity.
Depreciation. No, you've got exclusivity, but there's no timing difference here. So I am sending bills out.
But Kevin is saying because he's attributing the need to expend that money to the condition of license, he's going to consider it a cost of license, not revenue.
Cost of license, not revenue, irrespective.
I just, building on what Kevin was saying, I think there's two components of what you're able to charge the customer. One is cost recovery, and then you're entitled through your license to have a profit element. And is that profit element your revenue stream? And the rest is cost recovery.
I'm really confused now because I thought we want to solve how to allocate revenue, but finally we don't have any revenue for this
revenue. This is why I've now gone very quiet, because I'm thinking we're only showing the net margin as our revenue and we're not. Yeah.
We have 2 minutes, Shane. What should we do? Discuss this in one case? Well,
I think I know we haven't covered options C and D, but I think that what we've talked about probably gives us a lot of what we need, and we'd just be repeating.
Maybe ask the question what the debit and credit is for the two in year one in the fourth case.
Oh, that's a good point. Yes. So in the fourth option, we charge customers two for each of the first 2 years before we've actually constructed the plant and brought it into use. So what do we do with the two in the first year?
Sounds like a prepayment. I don't
prepayment of revenue?
Prepayment of what?
Prepayment of the cost of this condition that Peter's
Peter
given
condition.
Me. Yeah, I'm sorry I'm stuck on that page. But
so it's debit, cash, credit, what?
I've got a performance obligation. I've got to build this new water plant, so it's credit liabilities. I've got an onerous contract. If I don't build the water plant, he's going to come beat me up. So I've got an onerous contract.
And then when you build the plant, debit liability.
Yeah. How do you get the liability off your balance sheet
when I've performed?
So that's amortized over the life of the plant.
Over the condition of the license. All he's done is given me the pre-funding as opposed to the government grant, so I end up with the liability.
And is that a revenue item or is that a net against costs?
Net against costs again.
So would you get, sorry, just going back into the government grant example, would you not go down the line in that case that you do the second option in IS20, which is you wouldn't have the PP&E on your balance sheet because you would just net the 20 off the cost of that? Right ahead.
It's an alternative.
But the concept, I don't get onto that page because the concept of now selling water to Stephen with no plant on my balance sheet to produce it just seems crazy.
So?
You don't permit me under IAS 16 to depreciate all my assets very quickly. I've got to consider always their useful life over which their income generating capacity is.
But that's
so
the point. You didn't actually pay for the plant.
It doesn't matter.
So
I did pay for the plant. It's a condition of the. I paid for the plant via the condition.
Okay, as I said, we will not have any revenues, but Mary, you have the last word.
I was just going to say what I take away from this, and one of the reasons I've been more active here is I'm one of the board members working with Jane on regulated is a different type of reaction from this group than we have heard from most of the groups who've been engaged to date, which has included preparers, mostly but not solely from the industry, as well as others who commented on the DP, some with a specialist background and some with not. There were some issues, and that's what drove the case studies that you got about what was the activity that drove the recognition of the revenue. So it was more a timing issue. Could you have a performance obligation to the Peters of the world, in which case maybe constructing the plant is the revenue generating activity, or is it only as you put the plant into operation and then you have the knock-on tweaks of things like what if government grant, et cetera. And what we're hearing from you so far is that I think you're thinking much more cost of the license approach is the very high level generalization I would give as the strand running through the comments. So I'm not sure where we take that, given it that it kind of runs at odds with the overall feedback from the discussion paper, but this is early in the discussion, so certainly try and report it that way as we think about what next steps, and we may be back with fewer debits and credits and more focus on why people might think it was or wasn't as we explore this one further. Is that?
Yeah, that's a good summary. It's kind of helped clarify some things and then confused
totally confused
other things. But the more we have to build into our analysis, the better. And getting a fresh view has been very, very helpful. So thank you very much indeed.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you all. I think we had a very lively discussion today about this different topic. Thank you all for coming here and really contributing. And I think we received a lot of input from you. And thanks a lot for that.
Thank you.
That's it. Have a good night.
We have another private session.
Yes, another
we have a closed
private session.
Is it even worth
it? To the complete picture.